My name is Heather Miller Rubens. I am 37 years old. Today's date is June 6, 2016. We are in Baltimore, Maryland, and I'm here with Chris Layton, the founding executive director of the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies, and my friend and mentor.
My name is Chris Layton. I'm 66. Today is June the 6th, 2016. We're in Baltimore, Maryland, and I'm with Heather Rubens, the next executive director of the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies, my special friend and somebody who has become a very important partner in the work that I have enthusiastically embraced over the last 29 years.
Would you begin at the beginning of the Institute in 1987 and tell me more about what you thought you were getting into and what you hoped and dreamed you would accomplish?
I had no idea, really, what I was getting into. I was fascinated with this and very troubled by a long history of fraught Christian-Jewish relations, and had in my studies and in my relationships with a number of people come to be haunted by the question whether it was possible for Christianity to lay claim to its affirmations and to speak its truth, its make known its beauty and wisdom, without at the same time negating and demeaning, putting down Judaism and the Jewish people. And so I wanted to work at this whole enormously vexed challenge of seeing if it was possible for Christians and Jews to write a new story, to redeem an old story, and to write a new chapter where we honestly confronted what has gone awry in our relationship and discover that there is something powerful and transformational in stepping outside of the temple of the familiar and getting to know people who see the world and understand it very differently, and who can challenge us and disrupt us and lead us to think in new and exciting directions.
So the Institute was founded originally to deal with Christian-Jewish relations specifically and that particular history. And you've overseen the transition to include the Muslim community here in Baltimore in that conversation. And our Institute changed its name just in January of this year of 2016 to reflect that move. We used to be the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies. Now we're the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies. How do you feel about that shift and that inclusion in 2016 when you think about what the original mission was in the beginning?
I think there were two parts to the initial mission. On the one hand, to look at and examine the ways in which our religious traditions have been shaped through adversarial or oppositional perceptions of the other. To come to terms with the underbelly of our traditions and to confront some of the negative patterns of self-definition. So the negative critical examination, the critique of our traditions, was absolutely foundational. But the positive side was that there is an imperative to wake up to the beauty of a tradition about which many of us know very little, because most of us spend our lives hunkered down in one tradition without much familiarity with how the world looks when one stands in a different cultural and religious space. So that opportunity, if you will, of breaking outside of the insularity of one's own experience, there's something irresistible about being lured into another world and being shaken out of one's complacency. So, Heather, tell me a little bit about how it is you came to the Institute and what attracted you, given the fact that, as a brilliant historian, there were all kinds of other opportunities for you to go into teaching at a university or at doing any a variety of the vocational pursuits.
I think I was attracted to the Institute because it mixes academic work and thinking about life and asking important questions with service to the community, and bringing people together to have important conversations and understand each other in different contexts in a real meaningful way. While I do enjoy reading and writing in isolation, I think there's something special also about teaching in a public way and in community, and the Institute really provides that space for both research and for conversation. So that was what initially attracted me. And I think over the last 4 years, the work has really grabbed me as far as working with religious leaders and working with people in the public and being able to invite great speakers to Baltimore to have these kind of public conversations has been a real opportunity and I think an important service, and particularly with the current political and cultural climate, the amount of fear and concern people have about religion and religious difference and the incredible low lack of literacy people have with regards to religious communities and each other, that this work is really important.
So there is such a high level of fear out there. What do you think people are afraid of? Why would this in some cases virulent polemical assaults on Muslims, and if we look around the world, we see how various other groups, whether it's Jews, in some cases Christians, are viewed with such distrust and suspicion, and indeed sometimes the judgments about atheists and agnostics get very pronounced on the one hand. On the other hand, there is a sense that religious people are also to be feared because they have a way of encroaching on the public space and taking over. And tell me a little bit about what you think animates the fears that are so rampant in this country around religion and perhaps that reverberate around the world.
I think the fear in my 37 years of life comes from lack of knowledge of both facts, but also lack of opportunity for a real relationship. I think that there's a way in which we read and see, you know, 2-minute videos or little sound bites of people or information, or the Quran says this, the Bible says this, therefore we need to do this. And what does that actually look like and sound like when you know a Muslim, when you know a Jewish person, when you know a Christian, when you know an atheist? And I think that that looks and sounds a little bit different when you hear it in the sort of loud, cacophonous media space. If you know those people and you think, well, hey, my friends, doesn't really seem like someone who's going to go run off and do something harmful to society or to community or to myself, I shouldn't be as threatened. And so I think that's also what attracts me to the work, is that it's work of the head, but also work of the heart and bringing people into real relationship. So going into this moment of transition for the organization and for you, what are you most excited about for the Institute going forward, and what are you most concerned about?
Well, I'm excited about being able to sleep in a little bit later. I'm looking forward to actually being able to read a book and perhaps do a little more writing. But for the Institute, I'm really excited because I think we're at a moment of great transition. And not only are we tackling a very wondrous, vast, complex tradition, namely Islam, and recognizing that Western civilization is not just about Jewish, Christian, other philosophical encounters, but Islam is really a crucial part of the story. And so to recover a much deeper, richer sense of Islam is to have our horizons expanded and a much deeper self-understanding emerge. So that clearly excites me. I also think it's an exciting moment in that the ICJS, as you and our younger scholars are defining it, is moving into encounters with audiences and constituencies that we really have not paid adequate attention to. I see us becoming much more integral to the conversation between blacks and whites. I see us becoming much more integral to a conversation with nonprofit leaders, with vocational groups, whether they're lawyers or first responders or people who are working in a variety of fields who really don't have the opportunity to think about religion and what are the core beliefs, values, and practices that define who they are and that come to influence their lives in very powerful ways. So insofar as the ICJS can be an incubator for surprising friendships, it has a bright and enormously important role to play, not only here in Baltimore, but I think modeling for other cities the possibilities of new relationships that really will hold and bind a city together.
I want to talk a little bit more about Baltimore. So you came to Baltimore how many years ago?
Yeah, I came to Baltimore about 38 years ago and am still considered a newcomer in the eyes of many. The one statistic that really stood out was that there was a very high murder rate that was brought to my attention. So there was a sense that Baltimore was a troubled urban center. And here I was going to work in an independent school, which was primarily geared to helping the entitled and privileged go to the top colleges in the country. And so this question of what does it mean to be working in an independent school that nevertheless is situated in a city that is facing huge challenges. And that question was very much on my mind as I came to Baltimore and wondered, what does it mean to make a home here? How about you? You also came from Chicago was your last stop, as you were.
Last port of call, yes. And we moved here in 2011, and I still feel like I'm trying to figure out what's going on here in Baltimore and how it fits into kind of the larger American story. But it seems to me that there's real possibility in Baltimore and that it's probably the most diverse place I've lived outside of Chicago, but also like Chicago is really segregated in really interesting ways. And so how can we as a sort of nonprofit educational organization go into different spaces and try to break down that segregation? I think that is a conversation that can happen here that can't necessarily happen in other American cities, but that needs to probably happen in more American cities. And so that both excites me, but I also am nervous about walking into things that I don't necessarily know anything about. Stepping on some toes in the process. So hopefully I will be forgiven when that happens inevitably. So.
One of the things, Heather, that really struck me about coming to Baltimore, and again, it sort of took me by surprise, the school where I was working had a significant and really talented Jewish student population, and therefore also Jewish parents who were well-grounded in their traditions and knowledgeable. And here I'd gone through seminary and was very much anchored in my own Christian tradition. And my second year of teaching, and by the way, I was teaching Hinduism and Buddhism to 10th graders. During my second year, my father, who had been struggling with Alzheimer's disease, died. And what really overwhelmed me was the number of Jewish students who wrote really sensitive letters of condolence and who were eager to reach out and in some sense open themselves to my own sense of loss and grief. And it led me to say there's something really special about this community. And again, my wife and I found ourselves invited time and time again to Shabbat dinners, and the Jewish community really welcomed me in a way that frankly took my breath away. And so while there was study that I embarked on shortly after I arrived, I think it was those friendships that made such an impact and led me to be incorrigibly curious about this tradition, about which so little in my own education had really prepared me to understand.
So, do you feel that same sense of curiosity and possibility with regard to the Muslim community in Baltimore?
You know, I'm very much at the outset of this mm-hmm. Adventure, but I think that there is enormous possibility in coming to know a much broader array of Muslims. And again, one of the things that's so exciting about the Muslim community is the diversity. You know, not only is there an incredible ethnic and cultural range of experiences and backgrounds within the Muslim community, but the practices that and the ethos, the temperament of the Muslim community is anything but monolithic. So I see great excitement, or feel great excitement, about the possibilities of coming into deeper relationships with Muslims. How about yourself? What draws you and excites you about this move to engage Islam?
What excites me? I don't know if excite is the right word. I think what makes me feel a strong sense of urgency is the current conversation and the demonization of the whole class of people, and the fact that a presidential candidate can actually talk about banning Muslims from the country just terrifies me on a fundamental level. And I think that it's work that is really urgent. And I think that the experiences that I've had with Muslim friends and neighbors in the work, and also in my own life, that sense of fear and concern that they have, which I've sort of taken on also as part of my own fears and concerns. And so what can we do to make sure that the sort of great experiment in religious and ethical diversity in America continues to be that, a great experiment, as opposed to a recipe for real problems yeah. going forward. And so I think there's a certain level of anxiety that drives so I think it's sort of interesting that we've brought up grief and anxiety to a certain yeah. extent in this sort of place of negative or hard emotions, and also hard moments in conversations as like a locus for really important conversations and good interfaith work, mm-hmm. and one that may not necessarily come across as like an obvious place or space for that. And so I think that that sort of sense of concern is what really is animating a certain sense of urgency in my own work.
You know, I was really struck when a colleague described a moment where the front mailbox was opened and shut. It was a kind of slamming noise, and they went to the front door, and there was a letter. And this Muslim colleague had enormous anxiety, wondering what might be in that envelope, anticipating perhaps some outrageous note from a neighbor or a threat of one sort or another. And for the first time in their lives, they had this deep anxiety that maybe they just plain weren't welcome, that they didn't belong. And then opening up the letter in fear that their kids might be threatened or something awful would be in its content, and the relief that it was only an announcement about an increase in the homeowners' fees that were going to be boosted. But again, I think it's so hard for many of us who have not really experienced what it is to be a minority to understand and appreciate the precarious condition in which they find themselves. And you're right. The challenge, it seems to me, is to recognize that our destinies are interwoven, and that the promise of the American dream hinges upon our ability to really welcome and allow ourselves to be educated through a whole array of relationships, which right now seem all too difficult to make happen.
Yeah, that's what I think is the most exciting thing about the work, is the possibility of actually helping people come together across religious lines and racial lines and also economic lines to try to have a more, and maybe that's also a bit naive to a certain extent, or a bit pie in the sky, but I think it's an important goal to always have in mind when we're thinking about what we're doing, what we're writing, what we're saying, who we're trying to get together.
Were there people in your life, Heather, that really helped shape your own commitment to the kind of work you're doing now?
I would say my uncle, Father Mike Shelbley, of blessed memory, he passed away last year, was a diocesan priest in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and was a huge influence in my Catholic identity and my commitment to a church that isn't perfect. And what does it mean to stay in a community that's broken and got problems, and sometimes as a woman also makes me feel like an outsider. And he was an amazing, dynamic sort of, very much like the 1960s, 70s radical priest who was out doing social justice work and trying to bring people in and trying to be of service to the most sort of broken people. Mm-hmm. And so he's always served as a real model for me of what it means to be in community and what it means to live in a world that is a little bit broken, and to keep waking up every day and trying to make it better, mm-hmm. even on the smallest scales. He also had just an amazing capacity to believe that everything was going to work out, even in the most unlikely of circumstances, or when he put himself into sort of crazy situations. I'm certainly a much more of a planner than he ever was, but also that sort of spirit of being able to just ride with whatever's going on around you, I try to bring with me.
Were there experiences that you had with him that allowed you to really see him in action?
I would say there's two experiences that are really formative. One, we were going to like a big family event, and I was probably 17 or 18 at the time. And so I just learned how to drive relatively recently. And so he told me I could drive his car and he would ride with me, and we would drive. This was in rural Wisconsin. We were driving like 4 or 5 hours together to get to a place. And he had this car that he gotten hand-me-down that was just awful. It had rusted out. You could actually see part of the road in the back underneath, and it was literally held together by duct tape, but he didn't sort of care or worry about those things as long as it was moderately safe to to go in. And anytime we began a trip, we prayed the rosary, and so he was going through the rosary and going through the mysteries and saying the prayers, and we were doing it kind of call and response, and it was really warm. And he also refused to have air conditioning also, so we had the windows down. And I have this sort of visceral memory of praying and being sweaty and hot and angry and really annoyed that we were doing this, but doing it anyway. And that sort of idea of the importance of routine and sometimes you're not in a religious frame of mind, but you do it anyway because it's a habit, and that sort of sense of community with someone. And the other thing, he and I traveled around the South Pacific after I studied abroad. And I was 20 years old in college, and we ended up in Papua New Guinea and in Port Moresby, and he was visiting the Christian brothers there that he had known. And we didn't know it at the time, but he was sort of in the early stages of Alzheimer's. And so I was traveling with him for quite a while, and we were out in Port Moresby, and people were begging, and he gave away all of our money to those people. And I was moved by this, but also worried and mildly horrified that here we are in a foreign country, and now we have no money whatsoever, and what are you doing giving away literally everything that we have? And he's like, oh, don't worry, it'll work out, we'll figure it out. We have better connections than these people, so we have a responsibility to help with what we have. And he was absolutely right, and we were obviously fine, and were able to continue on our trip without any troubles. Mm-hmm. But that sort of sense of panic that I had of like, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? We literally have nothing. And his just breezy way of saying, no, it's fine.
Yeah. You know, rarely does one actually see the gospel embodied in that manner, where the vulnerability suddenly isn't just an idea.
Yeah.
But there you are.
Yeah.
And it will be your turn to put your hand out.
For help.
Yeah.
Is there anyone in your life that has sort of helped shape who you have become?
I mean, there's so many people. I've been thinking so much about this student, actually a classmate, when I was attending this funky prep school in Connecticut. It was a very small school, and so many of the students there were on scholarships of one sort or another. And this roommate of mine, his name is Earl George, came from Harlem, and his family had very little, and he grew up having to fight his way to survive, and his whole experience of coming to know girls and discovering intimacy was beyond my wildest imaginings. And so here we are studying American history, and time again, he was challenging the assumptions of the writer of this history book, constantly saying, this isn't my history. This history is rendering me invisible. And the anger and the rage at being left out of the American story was so palpable that it led me to the realization that my education begins by learning to step outside of my familiar, habitual way of seeing things, that the people who would become most important to me would be those who would challenge and contest my normal way of making sense of the world, that disruption was a real gift. And so Earl disrupted me over and over again. I like to think I did the same to him from time to time. And I think similar things happened along the way as I became familiar with people in the Jewish community. I can remember attending a Holocaust conference, and I was seated at a luncheon next to a woman. And for some reason, you know, sometimes you're on a plane or sometimes you're going somewhere and you get talking to somebody, and it turns out that there's an intimacy that is surprising, that erupts, takes hold so quickly and automatically. Well, this woman turned out, as we were telling our stories, revealed that she had been in Auschwitz. And her question to me, which was not accusatory, but just born out of a deep curiosity, was, I don't understand how you, knowing what a troubled history, can remain a Christian, given the fact that from my experience, I can't help but believe that the Jewish community, the Jewish people would have been better off if Christianity had never existed. How is it that you hold faith to such a tradition?
What did you say?
I think I probably stammered and stuttered, but I said that I could no more disown my tradition than I could disown my family, and that the work that I have to do is to come to grips with that legacy and to make sure that it does not do harm, indeed does good in the world, and that that is the reason I will remain within my tradition, because I refuse to give up on it, just as I will refuse to give up on my family.
What do you want your legacy to be in Baltimore and at the Institute?
That's such a big question. I hope that the Institute will be a place where people who normally would not get to know each other converge and forge surprisingly rich, deep, and enduring friendships. That sense of connection that will bind people from different educational, socioeconomic, racial, and religious backgrounds will be made possible by the ICJS. What's your hope and dream?
I am both amazed and delighted by the opportunity to take such an amazing organization into a new direction, into a new iteration in the 21st century, but while still trying to honor and keep the spirit that animated the work that you and our community have done to build this place, to have those types of conversations going forward. And I am excited, but I'm also, weighed down to a certain extent by the enormity of the inheritance, and wanting to make sure that I don't let folks down in the process of trying to reimagine what it means to think about religion and think about Baltimore and think about religious conversations and to bring people together.
Well, one of the things that makes retirement easy for me is knowing that the ICJS is in the hands of somebody so capable and so caring. I think that what you and the other scholars are making possible is the recognition that religion just isn't something confined to a private space, that it doesn't just live in Sunday mornings or Saturday mornings or Friday afternoons, but it shapes our political, our cultural, our economic climate in very powerful ways. And that religion is a force that, whether we like it or not, we have to reckon with. And so of all the people who are capable of demonstrating that religion holds such promise and such challenge, that you and the others at the ICJS are uniquely poised to bring that awareness to a much broader public. And so I sleep better and sounder knowing that you'll be at the helm.
Thank you. I sleep less.
I'm curious if one of you could describe a day at the Institute. Like, for a stranger who's never been there, is it the kind of place that you hold community events? Is it open to the public?
It is open to the public. So we have lectures and study workshops. We mix both. So we try to recruit different groups of people, so religious leaders, clergy, ministers, and educators come together regularly at the Institute to have study and conversation with each other. But then recently, we just had a series of lectures called Imagining Justice in Baltimore, where we brought three national scholars of religion to the Reginald Lewis Museum here in Baltimore to give their perspectives on sort of a Christian perspective, a Jewish perspective, and a Muslim perspective on what justice in America looks like today. And those events were free and open to the public and brought over 200 people together to on three separate nights to have really important public conversations. And so it's a mix. One of the things I like about the Institute is every day looks a little bit different than every other day. And depending on the week where I am and who I'm talking to shifts, which is really nice. But it speaks to what Chris was talking about before, about the need to see how religion and religious individuals and religious ideas sort of animate different spaces. We also work with seminarians and rabbinical students and just came out of an intensive course, a four-credit course, with local seminarians and rabbinical students from around the country coming together for a week-long retreat out at the Pearlstone Retreat Center. And so that's teaching kind of future religious leaders what it means to have interreligious literacy and comfort level with each other and with those two particular traditions. And we want to expand that to have a parallel Muslim-Christian and a Jewish-Muslim program as well going forward.
I like to think of the ICJS as an educational playground where all kinds of people from various backgrounds and experiences can come together, whether they're clergy or educators or students, adults, college students, a whole array of people. And at the ICJS, we raise unsettling questions, and we learn new ways of reading and interpreting our sacred texts and traditions, scrutinizing our practices, really looking at questions about how do we construct meaning, how do we find a place and create a sense of belonging. And we do that in different ways, obviously. And sometimes we do it in ways that are troublesome, that need to be scrutinized and, in some cases, rethought and reconfigured.
The one thing I would shift slightly is that we also have a lot of fun. That it's actually a place with a huge amount of humor. And that's one thing that I've actually really appreciated in the last couple of years, is the ability to have humor play an important role in interreligious conversations. Mm-hmm. When you're dealing with the weighty, heavy, difficult histories, difficult questions, contemporary questions, the ability to laugh with somebody else, whether that is absolutely essential, lest we all sort of curl up in balls and decide we can't get out of bed in the morning to deal with the sort of weight of the world. And so I think that the other thing we do really well is laugh together, both at what the sort of current challenges are. Not that we're laughing at the challenges, but laughing in the face of the challenges.
Yeah, there are just so many occasions for embarrassment.
Yes.
So many occasions for awkwardness, because we're constantly bumping into how much we don't know. And when we get close to people, we invariably step on toes. And so there are lots of opportunities to both weep and to laugh. And we do some of both.
Yeah, I think that's a good spot to end the conversation. I think I look forward to many years ahead of both weeping and laughing at the ICJS. I undoubtedly will be calling you with many questions going forward. So I appreciate your friendship and your mentorship and the amazing gift that you gave to Baltimore with the Institute.
Well, we'll continue to make mischief as best we can.